Okay, thank you. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to deliver a talk in this conference. So my talk will be devoted to Lefschetz theorems. And actually, it will have three parts. The first part of my talk will be devoted to, well, a discussion of Lefschetz theorems in, let's say, classical algebraic geometry. The second one on some arithmetic analog concerning arithmetic surface. And the second part is basically joint work with Antoine Chamberlois, and he will give some more details on some of the theorems I will describe in the second part today's afternoon in his talk. And the last part will be devoted to some recent work in progress devoted to arithmetic threefold. Okay. So, by Lefschetz theorems, in this conference, I mean the so-called, let's say, weak Lefschetz theorems, not the Lefschetz-Vache. So, there are the Lefschetz theorems which compare the geometry or the topology of a projective variety, let's say a smooth or regular enough projective variety, with the topology or the geometry of an hyperplane section. So it can be, as you wish, intersection of X with an hyperplane H of some hypersurface in the projective space. Okay, so as you know, the theorems have a long and intricate and interesting story. So, of course, one of the main instances of the theorems are due to Lefschetz, and they appear in his great book in 24, where he used systematically algebraic topology to study the geometry of higher dimensional algebraic varieties. So basically, Lefschetz proved by really, let's say, concrete geometrical arguments that if you consider some smooth projective complex variety of dimension n, Vn, and if you consider an hyperplane in the projective space, then the relative homology group of Vn with respect to the intersection vanish under the dimension of the variety, under the complex dimension of the variety. Of course, in terms of comparing the topology of V and of its hyperplane section Vn of V inter H, it means that these two varieties have the same homology groups in dimension strictly less than n minus 1, and you have a map which is onto in dimension n minus 1. Okay, so of course, the work of Lefschetz, the real innovation in Lefschetz was to deal with algebraic varieties of any dimension, and indeed, for varieties of smaller dimensions, it was basically very well known at the time of Lefschetz. For instance, the simplest case of this theorem is that if you cut an irreducible projective variety of dimension at least 2 by an hyperplane, the intersection is connected. And it's very difficult actually to trace back the origin of this theorem. In this n-dimensional version, it's certainly in Bertini, but maybe in previous Italian geometers. For surfaces, it's basically considered as obvious in the classical literature. Well, indeed, Picard himself proved the case of Lefschetz theorems for surfaces at the level of H1. And there is an absolutely extraordinary paper of Castelnuovo and Henriques in 96, which deal with H1 of arbitrary varieties. Actually, they use an argument of odd structures and rigidity of odd structures, which is very impressive. Well, and as you know, over the complex numbers, there have been many developments of this Lefschetz theorems. For instance, by using Morph theory, it's possible to get theorems about homotopy groups, and to deal with singular spaces, and so on. So I did write a few names. And as it is not what I will really be interested in, I just gave a reference. You can look at an interesting reference in the Fulton surveys in 87. Okay, so in this talk, I will be really interested into the purely algebraic approaches to Lefschetz theorems. So basically, Lefschetz theorems in a pure or in abstract algebraic geometry over any algebraically closed field, well, that kind of result goes back to Zariski in the 50s, for instance, who proved connectedness results, and indeed introduced the theory of formal functions, basically to prove that kind of statement. And of course, it is the main topic of SGA2, the Grothendieck seminars, in 62. And the point of this seminar is to use systematically the cohomological methods on he uses formal geometry on duality arguments to give a purely algebraic approach to Lefschetz theorems, type theorems. Okay, so I need to review a little bit the content of SGA2. So basically, theorems in SGA2 involve two conditions, which are denoted left on left, which I want to explain. Okay, so let me explain the basic ideas of Grothendieck in a rather simple context, where we work over a field, K. So assume that X is some algebraic variety over K, or scheme. Well, we may think for simplicity of a projective scheme over K. And suppose you are given a closed subscheme, Y. Okay, so basically the techniques in SGA2 use as some kind of intermediate step between Y and X, the formal completion of X along Y. So that is the limit of the successive thickening Yn of Y in X. Okay, so if you have some Courant shift, for instance, on X or on some Zariski neighborhood of Y, you may, so to speak, restrict it to this completion. You may look at it as in the infinitesimal neighborhood of infinite order of Y in X, X hat. And of course, formally, it's exactly the projective limit of the restriction to the successive thickenings, Yn of Y in X. Okay, so with this notation, Grothendieck introduces the following two conditions. The first condition is the so-called Lefschetz condition. And it asserts that, okay, for any vector bundle over some open neighborhood U of Y and X, the section, the morphism, the linear map, if you wish, which sent a global section of E over U to its restriction to this completion X hat of Y in X is an isomorphism. So actually in the literature there are variously phrased conditions. You may ask to have this for a fixed U on every E, and you may ask to have this, okay, for every E there is on any U arbitrarily small and so on. Okay, let me keep this rather in this vague form. And besides this first condition, there is another condition which is called condition de l'échelle effective, so it's left with two F, which asserts that not only you have the first condition, but moreover, if you have a formal vector bundle on X hat, a locally free current sheaf on this complexion X hat, actually it comes from some real vector bundle E over some Zariski neighborhood. So, roughly speaking, the first condition is a condition concerning morphisms between vector bundles and the fact that you don't lose any information if you restrict it to the completion. And the second condition is a condition dealing with objects in the category of vector bundles, and you have to be able. It requires you to be able to construct actual vector bundles from formal vector bundles. Okay, so in the simplest case where X is a scheme over a projective scheme, let's say over K, the basic result of SJA2 may be phrased in the following way. So for simplicity, assume that X is smooth and projective. And now assume that Y is an ample hypersurface in X. And then it turns out that when the dimension of X is at least 2, the first Lefschetz conditions dealing with sections or morphism between vector bundles holds, and that when the dimension of X is at least 3, the stronger effective Lefschetz conditions telling you that you may algebraize formal vector bundles holds. Okay, so let me make a few comments on this theorem. So of course, as you imagine, in SJA2, not only this naive version of our field is considered, but actually Grothendieck considers an obvious relative situation where X, let's say, is proper or projective over a base scheme, let's say a Noetherian base scheme S, and where Y is a relative Cartier divisor, which is ample relatively to S. And basically the same theorem holds, but now the dimension conditions are conditions concerning the dimensions, or if you don't to have too much smoothness assumption, the depth of the fibers. A second comment concerning Lefschetz theorems is that actually in the literature.
The right one.
I am afraid it's very difficult. I will try. But I suppose I have to explain a quite technical point, because it's very confusing the first time you look at SJA2. In SJA2, you have global statements concerning projective schemes, and you have local statements. And roughly speaking, the idea behind this local statement is the following. Suppose you are considering Y on X projective as before, embedded in some projective space. You may really look at the cones in the affine space of one dimension more in AF plus 1 if you start with closed subskin in PN. So you may consider the cone over Y, the cone over X, and of course these cones contains the origin 0. And of course, a vector bundle over X gives you, by obvious pullback, some kind of homogeneous vector bundle on the cone where you deleted the origin zero, of course. So it's quite natural to investigate the Lefschetz conditions for the pointed cone CY minus zero into the pointed cone of X, CX minus zero. And at this point, you may consider a more general problem. You start with some Noetherian local ring A, and you consider its spec, which it takes the role of CX. You delay the closed point, and you may consider, for instance, an hypersurface F equals zero minus the closed points. And you may want to deal with the Lefschetz conditions in this context. So it may look very okay, a little bit strange, but it's quite important. Indeed, the point is that if you get some Lefschetz theorem in this local situation, you get Lefschetz theorem for the cone, and you get projective Lefschetz theorems. So the local theory is stronger than the global theory. And it's very interesting to know that that kind of very technical results is actually the best two Lefschetz theorems in the literature are due to Reynaud and Faltings. And they have been recently used in the context of deformations of Galois representations in Skinner and Wiles. So you have here, you have some kind of very technical stuff. And it's very puzzling that in some sense, in what I will describe later in the arithmetic case, I will stick to the global, more naive global point of view. I don't know what is this better local point of view in the arithmetic case. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on this. I would rather explain a little bit how, from the less and less conditions, you may deduce, well, concrete or naive geometric consequences. So let's go back to the previous framework. So you have Y in X, and you introduce this completion X hat of Y in X. So for simplicity, let me assume that X is smooth and projective. So a first consequence of the Lefschetz conditions, let's say of less, the naive Lefschetz condition, is that Y and X have the same P0, have the same set of connected components. And that's basically obvious. And the proof goes as follows. It's a tautology that Y and X hat have the same pi naught because they have the same underlying topological space. And now you may detect the connected components of X hat by looking at independent sections of the structural sheaves in X hat. And okay, on the same over X. And the Lefschetz conditions tells you that you have some isomorphism between global. You apply the Lefschetz condition to the trivial line bundle, and it shows you immediately that idempotence in the global functions over X corresponds bijectively to idempotence in the global functions on X hat. So they have the same connected components. Okay. So you get this old results of connectivity for D at least 2. Okay, now you may play the same, a similar game with the et al. Fundamental group. Here again, more it's basically tautological that Y and X hat have the same et al. Fundamental group because basically the definition of an et al. Map, you may extend some an et al. Covering of Y to an et al. Covering of X hat. And now you describe etal covering of X hat of X by their some algebra, some sheaf of algebra over X hat, which corresponds to the direct image of the regular function of the covering. And you extend the sheaves, and you get at least no you don't want to extend the sheaves. You want, for instance, to get the fact that at the level of pi one it's on two. you need only to have a property of the unicity of the extension, and it comes from the left set transition. And now if you are able to extend sheaths, which occur in dimension at least 3, you have this effective left set condition, and you may extend a finite etal covering of X hat to some, let's say, open neighborhood of Y in X, and then by purity you extend it over all of X. So you get that pi 1 etal is defined some is, well, at the level of pi 1 etal, the inclusion between X hat and X is an isomorphism. That's how you get some in a purely algebraic proof of some results of a fundamental group. And you can play a similar game with Picard groups. So the Lefschetz conditions gives you an injection between the Picard group of X and the Picard group of the completion. The effective Lefschetz conditions gives you a bijection. And for instance, if you are over C, on you may use the Kodera vanishing theorem to get some cohomological vanishing over Y. And the vanishing conditions allows you to, for instance, to see that if you have two line bundles over X hat, which are isomorphic over Y, they are isomorphic over X hat by constructing by lifting an isomorphism step by step. And of course, this condition is of only some H1, and a similar condition on H2 allows you to extend a line bundle on Y to a line bundle on the successive neighborhoods, and you get a line bundle on X hat, and then by Lefschetz, you get a line bundle over X, or maybe on some open set, and then by some kind of purity, you go to X. Okay. So that's, once you have this very strange looking conditions left on left, you get real geometry by this. Well, for instance, if you have, for instance, the isomorphism of pi 1 means exactly that finite etal covers of X are in bijections, well, up to isomorphism, with finite etal cover of X hat. And the point is that if you, okay, for instance, how do you extend a finite etal cover of X hat? You represent it by a sheaf of algebra, blah, 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 blah. You extend the sheaf of algebra, and that's it. Oh, the injectivity means you have only to be able to prove that if you have two etal covering which are isomorphism, which are isomorphic on X hat, they are isomorphic everywhere. Yeah. And you interpret this as an isomorphism of sheaf of algebra on X hat, which, well, you extend.
Yeah, but that doesn't work in dimension 2.
Sorry?
That doesn't work in dimension 2, right?
Oh, yes. The point is, it works. Well, the point is, it will give you, at some point you need some purity, because you will get this over some open neighborhood, but this open, the complement of some, Y is ample. So anything in the complement has to have dimension, codimension at least 2. And I have to suppose X to be smooth, and then you apply purity. Well, actually, some related work was developed by Hironaka and Matsumura in the 60s, and they were interested in the following type of question. So again, you consider X, let's say, a projective reducible variety over some field, and Y close to variety, and you consider the completion X hat. And Hironaka and Matsumura compare the fields of rational function over X, K of X, on the fields of the so-called formal rational function of X hat. So in this situation, you may consider, let's say, a sheaf of fraction fields of the structural sheaf on X hat, and its global sections, that are the formal rational functions of X hat. It's a somewhat tricky definition, because that kind of sheaf is not quasi-coherent in general. So, but anyway. And Hironaka and Matsumura defines y to be G3 in X when this inclusion of fields is actually an equality. So to be G3 means exactly that if you have formal rational functions on this formal neighborhood, X hat of y in X, actually it extends to real rational functions on the wall of X. And indeed, you have quite, well, it turns out that you have many interesting instances of G3 embeddings. For instance, any severity of positive dimension is a projective space, is G3. I suppose this, well, it's not explained in Hironaka and Matsumura, but results of this type were known to Severi. Severi proved that if you have a complex meromorphic functions on a small neighborhood, complex neighborhood of a curve in P3, it extends to rational functions in P3. Okay. For instance, an ample curve in a surface. And it turns out that, of course, over C, all these things are a lot of relations with the theory of pseudo-concavity. And results, well, on G3 embedding have been proved by many authors, including Chow and Feltings. Okay. Now, let me turn to the arithmetic situations. You may wonder, what are left-shared theorems on arithmetic schemes? So assume you are given two projective flat schemes over G, X and Y. For simplicity, assume that X is regular, and assume that Y is an hyperplane section of X. So in this situation, of course, you may apply the results of AGA2. And you get that the left-shed condition and the effective left-shed condition holds when the dimensions are large enough. And as explained before, you have to consider the relative dimension and the threshold dimensions are 2 and 3. But of course, on the other side, you may consider the classical analogy between number fields and function fields, or the, well, Arakelov's geometry philosophy, and then you would expect to have some kind of arithmetic analog of the left-shed conditions, which would involve some kind of complex analysis or geometry of the complex points of X and Y, and which would hold when the absolute dimension are at least 2 and 3. That will be the natural analogs. So of course, when you compare the results in FGA2 with your expectation, you see that you are missing two cases, the limiting cases, when X is as dimension 2 for the left-shed condition, and when X has dimension 3 for the effective left-shed conditions. And that's precisely what I want to discuss in this talk. So, let me start with the case of arithmetic surfaces. Sorry? So, let me start by explaining a little bit more what happens in the geometric case on surfaces. So, assume you consider, let's say, a smooth projective surface X over some field, on Y a smooth projective connected curve. Why? And for instance, it turns out that you may prove left-shed type results as soon as the self-intersection of Y is positive. So it corresponds precisely to say that the line bundle O of Y is big on F. So in this case, of course, it's quite easy to see that you may find there exists a finite family of projective, there is only a finite family of projective curves on X which don't touch Y, whose intersection with Y is empty. And I will denote U, the complement of this exceptional curves. Okay, it turns out when this positivity condition holds, positivity of the self-intersection, first you have J3, and second you have left, and precisely with this U. And this is some kind of geometric model for what follows. So let me describe an arithmetic counterpart Well, it's difficult to move it because the last slide. I forgot to push the green button. So let me describe the arithmetic counterpart of the previous slide. So you start with the projective regular integral arithmetic surface, curly X, let's say over speckle K, where K is a number field, and assume that, okay, I will consider some curve, Y and X, and I will suppose to be given by section, an integral point over K, over OK. Okay? Now we are working in auricular geometry, so we need to have some additional complex analytic datum, and it will be for every, well, at every Archimedean place, you get a Riemann surface, X sigma of C, on a point, Y sigma, and the additional data are open neighborhoods, omega sigma of y sigma and x sigma of c. And for obvious reasons, you require this data to be invariant by complex conjugation. So, anyway, from this open neighborhoods, you may construct green functions associated to the point in this open set in the Riemann surface. So, as you know, these green functions are defined as the unique harmonic function in the complement of the points in the on the open set omega, which vanish at the boundary, and moreover, which have the logarithmic singularity at the given point y sigma. Well, so it turns out that you may define some natural capacitary norm on the tangent space, tangent line of the Riemann surface X sigma at this point Y sigma by considering the, let's say, the first term in this asymptotic expansion, some kind of regularized value of the Green function, but indeed, if you want to be coordinate free, define some metric. It's not a number. So you define this capacitary metric by this formula. And what takes place of the positivity assumption on the previous slide of the self-intersection of Y, or of the positivity of the degree of the normal line bundle of X of Y in X, will be the positivity of the I-curve degree of the normal bundle of Y in X equipped with the capacitary norms. Okay, so it turns out that when this positivity assumption, arithmetic positivity assumption, is satisfied, there exists only a finite subset of one-dimensional closed subscheme of curve, closed curves, if you wish, in X, which don't touch Y, on which at Archimedean places don't touch the small neighborhood. And basically, it's a, well, also a result of Fekete-Seger over P1 and extended later by Rumeli of an arbitrary curve. And you may introduce the complement of this curve. And then you have a statement which is really the counterpart of the previous one. In the geometric case, you have a G3 result. The rational functions on X correspond to formal rational functions over Y, which extend to meromorphic functions on this open neighborhood. And you have also some kind of flat result. Okay, so this may look somewhat technical, but it's quite, well, it's very easy to see that what it means in the simplest case. The basic example of this situation is P1. You take for X P1, for Y 0, for omega a disk of some radius R, then the Green function are basically the logarithm of Z, but of course you have to take care of the normalization given by the disk. So the capillary metric is 1 over R. So this degree is log of R. And the positivity condition amounts precisely to asking that R is greater than 1. And the G3 result gives you exactly the old theorem of Borel, telling you that if you have a slightly more general result. But it clearly contains this result of Borel, telling you that if you have a formal power series with Z coefficients, which define a function meromorphic on a disk or radius at least 1, then it is rational. Okay, so this afternoon, Antoine will give many more details about this, and actually will give much more refined versions, which include, let's say, periodic rigid analytic geometry at various finite places. And it will describe some applications of this to various questions, including classical and periodic modular forms. So maybe I could just say one additional word of comments, namely that it is possible to apply this to the pi 1, to the fundamental group, using the same philosophy, the same as in the geometric case. And for instance, suppose that you, for simplicity, that you are over spec Z. And in that case, using the left condition on the Minkowski theorem, telling you that the spec Z is simply connected, you may obtain that the obvious map for the profinite completion of the classical fundamental group of the open set omega. So the obvious map from this profinite completion to the Grothendieck fundamental group of X is onto. And indeed, it's very easy to find examples where it gives you something non-trivial. For instance, if you can do this with omega a disk, you get that pi 1 of X is trivial. Actually, with the previous notation, you get a more precise result that pi 1 of U is trivial. And for instance, you may prove that the pi 1 of this genus G arithmetic curve is 0, which is definitely not obvious a priori. Okay. Now, in the last part of my talk, I would like to describe some recent progress on left-left theorems now on arithmetic threefolds. And in that case, you expect to have some kind of effective left-left condition. You expect to be able to algebraize formal vector bundles. So let me describe this. So we will consider the following data. Now X will be again integral, regular, projective. Let's say, or maybe I should have had smooth. Flat over spec Z. And now we are in the dimension 3 case, absolute dimension 3. So it's a surface. You take it's a model of a true projective model of a projective surface over a number field. And Y will be a smooth divisor. Let's for simplicity, smooth divisor on X. And as before, you have an additional complex datum, which is some neighborhood omega of the set of complex points of Y in the set of complex points of X. So you see, Y of C is a Riemann surface, X of C is a complex surface, and you get a neighborhood. Okay, so to formulate the conjecture or the result in the circle, I need to introduce some kind of tricky construction, which mixes formal geometry and complex analytic geometry. So the simplest way to formulate this is to introduce some kind of ring topos. Well, actually, it's simpler than a topos. I already described the site. So you may consider some kind of Grothendieck topology. You consider open sets. You define a category of open sets with obvious products and so on. Well, defining this way, an open set will be an open set in Y, a very ski open set in Y, which is a scheme over Z, and an analytic open set in the complex point of X. And you require that the trace of this analytic open set U n in the Riemann surface Y of C is exactly the set of complex points of V. Things which glue together. And you may define some kind of sheaf of ring on this site. So a regular function on this U tilde will be given by a formal function on V, so a section of the completion of a formal function on X along Y. That's the first part of the thing, it's S hat, and it's given by, secondly, an analytic function on the analytic open set, and you require them to glue together in the sense that if you look at the formal analytic thing defined by S, it coincides with the one defined by S hat. Okay, so by using this, for instance, you might define vector bundles as a locally free sheaf of finite trunk, so that a vector bundle E tilde will be given by a formal vector bundle along Y, an analytic vector bundle on your analytic omega, and also you will have also some isomorphism between the two complex formal vector bundles you get by restricting Ian to the formal complex completion by going to the complex point for Iat, but it's not exactly that. You will get something of this time, which moreover satisfies something more. You need to have local frame along, let's say, the complex point of Y, which at the same time are holomorphic, but are integral in some sense. So it's something rather tricky. It's not exactly the triple. It's a Dutch triple which satisfies some additional condition. Okay. Okay, by using this technology, you may formulate the conjecture as follow. So assume that you are in the situation where you may find an Hermitian line bundle on X, a section of the line bundle L, which satisfies the following condition. First, the condition of numerical effectivity, the height of points is non-negative. Second, a condition of positive of positivity in the relative sense. So it means here that L is ample and the curvature of L bar is strictly positive. On suppose, of course, that Y is defined by the divisor of the section, and that this section is everywhere at most 1, and that omega is the open set where it is strictly less than 1. But if you think of it, you may understand the data in our theorem on arithmetic surface as in this terms. And then the conjecture that in this situation, any vector bundle E tilde in the previous sense over X tilde, so this is kind of things with glue, combine integral structure and ta-ta-ta, analytic things, is algebraizable. So it means that it will be the restriction to this X of some vector bundle on X minus maybe a small thing of composed of points of codimension 3, of closed points. And in rank 1, you may assume that it is 1. So I did formulate this as a conjecture, but with quotation marks. Well, indeed, I think I am able to prove it, but modulo a few verifications. And also, actually, I use a conjecture in pure analytic geometry, which is stated in a paper by Kosareff and Peternel, which is devoted exactly to the left condition in the context of analytic geometry, and they make some conjecture, and they give some vague proof without any details, without checking all the details. So I am quite confident that it works, but I have there are many checks to be done. Okay, so this framework may look a little bit complicated. So here again, you may consider the basic example. So instead of being a point in P1, it will be P1 in P2. And instead of with omega, which instead of being a disk, will be some kind of disk-shaped tube of some radius R around P1. And the positivity condition corresponds to R at least 1. Okay. So you have to think, I want to stress the fact that in this case, for instance, the Picard groups of the analytic objects or the formal objects, which are round, are terrible beasts. They are very huge groups. And for instance, it's very counterintuitive. For instance, this Picard group really depends on R. So you have holomorphic line bundles on some omega R for some R, you cannot extend to a larger R. It's very difficult to... For instance, it doesn't seem to be known that these analytic line bundles may be represented by divisors. So you are really struggling with strange animals. Okay. I should also say that actually this theorem is some kind of toy model for more general arithmetic algebraization theorems concerning, for instance, line bundles. And it's possible to formulate conjectures using the same formalism. For instance, dealing with line bundles, in the situation where Y is an arithmetic surface, and X will be the total space of the universal vector extension of an abelian scheme. And a similar conjecture in this context, mixed with some kind of periodic variance of the same kind as the one that Antoine will discuss in these lectures, will prove, for instance, this conjecture of August, telling you that you can characterize classes in H2, the RAM of a projective variety over a smooth projective variety over a number field, as you may characterize algebraic classes as the ones which have the good behavior under the crystalline Frobenius. So that's really the kind of thing you may expect someday to prove by using this technique. Well, at least in this situation, you already can give some applications to P1. Instead of getting some surjectivity of P1, you really determine the P1. So you find something in this situation, you may describe the P1 of X as some kind of amalgamated product of the P1 of the divisor, the completion of the P1 of the analytic thing, and you add some amalgamation along the pi 1 of the complex thing. So it's, well, I put some quotation marks because we have to take care of base points, and in general it's rather tricky, rather complicated. You have to describe things in terms of fundamental group weights, and also one has to take care of the complex conjugation in this. Okay, at least. But here, unfortunately, I have no concrete examples and dream of, okay, considering okay, Hilbert modular surfaces or something very nice, and to apply these theorems. Anyway, I would like to use the last minute of this talk to describe the ideas behind the proof of this conjecture. So, first, in this proof, I use a technical device, which is, which personally I like very much, which is this some kind of notion of dimension of the space of section is the Rakeloff setting for Hermitian vector bundles over curves. Okay, so let me describe this. So, suppose that E bar is an Hermitian vector bundle over spec Z, so this is a very concrete thing, it's exactly a Euclidean lattice. So what is the right definition of the dimension over F1 of the space of section of E bar? There is a natural definition which was introduced I learned this in some paper of Henri Gillet and Christophe Soulet, but I don't know if it was known before or in the air in 91. So which is, okay, take the number of points in the unit ball, point of the lattice point of the unit ball, and define this H naught as a logarithm. Okay, actually there is a variant of another definition, which is to take the logarithm of this kind of theta sum. On this, I suppose the first place I saw this was in the diploma arbeit of Damien Rosler in 93, where he explains that. And it was later rediscovered by van der Heer and Schroff. Well, actually, I suppose that's something really in the air. It's more or less clear. It's, I suppose for people like Ecker and Schmidt, F.K. Schmidt, it was clear. Because as you know, Ecker proved that Riemann-Rohr, proved that the functional equation is the Poisson formula. Schmidt proved that the functional equation is Riemann-Rohr. So you get that Riemann-Rohr is Poisson, and it's explained in these terms in Tate phases. And using the previous definition, it takes the following form. You may define H1 at H0 of the dual, and then you have H0 minus H1, which is the Rakeloff degree, and it's exactly the Poisson formula. And actually, these people work, quite classically, people work in a slightly different formalism, which I can explain in this way. You may work over any number of fields, and deal with Hermitian vector bundles over this number of fields. And now you can go down to spec Z by looking at the direct image. That is, you okay module E, you look at it as a Z module, and you define a new Hermitian metric by taking the sum of Hermitian metric at all the places. And then it's quite natural from the point of view of algebraic geometry to define HA, HI of E bar of the, this arithmetic curve as the HI of each push forward. And then, you may also introduce some kind of canonical Hermitian line bundles. Well, it's the relative Delevingne for spec OK over spec Z. You may equip it with a natural metric, which gives the trace a norm 1. So this is a classical definition. Basically, this is the definition of Hecker. And then you discover that you may play a little bit, and you see that your previous definition tells you that exactly that H1, it's H0 of the dual times omega bar, that's Riemann-Rohr, and you may express in that case the Riemann-Rohr of an arithmetic curve in this form. So you see really the log of the discriminant, which plays a role of 2t minus 2, as it has 2. Okay, so this is really in the air, it's well known, so to speak, but not that much used in the Rakeloff geometry. And of course, another motivation for this definition is that, of course, that kind of theta sums occur everywhere when you study lattices. For instance, when you study coding properties of lattices with Gauss and noise, it's a classical thing you can see, for instance, in Conway's book. It's, of course, related to the modular forms and set up to integral lattices. And it has been used rather recently to derive very non-trivial results in the geometry of numbers, first by Banaschik and more recently by Carlo Gasparri. And a last comment I would like to make, you see in the definition of H naught theta, you take, well, in the exponential, you take exponential of minus pi. So you have to understand why you have pi, and you have, of course, you have pi because you have this the Gaussian which has integral one, which you normalize it with a pi in this way. So that's really the natural. Okay. And it turns out that this invariant has nice properties. Of course, by definition, it's like a dimension, it's not negative. Secondly, it turns out that you may compare it with the older H naught. And it's, well, by using the functional equation for the theta function, it's very easy to derive this inequality. You can bound the difference purely in terms of the rank. And if of course, as you see, such a result is basically a Minkowski result because, as you know, H1 minus, well, you see H0 is at least as large as the degree because H1 is not negative. And so you get, okay, if the degree is large enough, you get some H0 is not zero, you have a small point of small norms. You get Minkowski. And for us, the really important property is the following one. Is that if you have a filtration, the H0 of your Hermitian vector bundle is at most the sum of the H0 of the subcoefficients. And here again, it's a very simple thing about lattices, which comes from the fact that the Gaussian function is of positive type. Its Fourier transform is non-negative. And actually, that kind of inequality was studied by Gillet, Mazur, and Soulet. But you're dealing with some kind of product balls and so on. And the point is that if you are really in this nice, well, if you work with Euclidean balls, it's not true in general. On here, on this picture, you can see it's not true. Hmm? You start with, well, it's not true in general, but it's true with the H0 theta. Okay. 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 So I would like to say a few words on the actual algebraization proof. So actually it was a technical. So let me try to explain the key idea by going back to the very heart of the classical argument of algebraization in the classical case. For instance, in the Gaga case or in the Grothendieck case for informal geometry. And actually this argument goes back to Codera and Spencer. And let me explain this in a simple case. So Codera and Spencer were interested in the following situation. You are given a smooth projective complex atrophic variety, an analytic line bundle, and you want to reprove an old theorem of Lefschetz again, the theorem on 1-1 classes, which actually means exactly that such an analytic line bundle is algebraic. So Codera and Spencer have the following cohomological approach. Okay, you work by induction on the dimension. So you consider an hyperplane section, smooth, nice hyperplane section, and you assume that you already know that the restriction of your analytic line bound on L on Y is algebraic. Okay, so to complete the proof, well, Codera and Spencer did know the theorem of Chow. So as soon as you prove that that L or a twist of L by a large power of ample line bundle has a non-zero section, basically you are done because the divisor of the non-zero section will be algebraic, and you will have written as you will O of this divisor will be the algebraic description of L. Okay, so you only need something. You need to find one non-trivial non-zero section. Okay. Okay, so the proof of Kober and Spencer goes as follows. And this key argument is really copied in Gaga by Serre, and again is a key point in Grothendieck. So you consider the exact sequential shifts defined by this section S, which define Y. You go to cohomology, so you get a long exact sequence in cohomology, H0, 0, 0, H1, H1, H1. And here, you know that L is the restriction of L on Y is algebraic. So you see that third terms are very well controlled. For instance, well, you may know, okay, that for instance, this H1 is 0. It's basically an algebraic result. And you know that the H0 is very large. D is large. Okay, now the key analytic point is the finite dimensionality of these two H1s. Because once you know that the H1s of L over X analytic of L twisted are finite dimensional, and you know that the last term is zero, where D is large enough, okay, so you see that the first H1 maps to on the second one. So you see that the dimension of this H1 as a function of D is not increasing. So at some point it has to be stationary. If it is stationary, the map has to be isomorphism. This map, so this, the previous map has to be zero, and if this is large, the things have to be large at some point. Okay. So really the key point is this finite dimensionality. Okay. On some naive arguments using positivity of dimension, if you wish. Here, in our setting, you are given some kind of this kind of tricky vector bundle E tilde over X, which mixes formal and analytic data. And actually, you might consider some kind of H1, so which is defined by looking at, let's say, the H1 in this site. So it will be some kind of OK modules. And moreover, it's naturally equipped with some kind of, well, semi-norm or pseudo-norm given by Hodge theory on omega on some open analytic space, well, a complex surface. So in this situation, so H1 in the analytic of, well, you see X hat is something basically of relative dimension 2. Right? Omega is a surface containing an ample curve. Well, these groups are very large. They have infinite rank. But in some sense, they are very well behaved. Well, in technical sense, for instance, in the complex situation, it's a classical fact that the cohomology groups, which have natural topology, are separated. You are working on non-compact manifolds, so you have a lot of technical difficulty with separatedness. And it turns out that in this case, it's separated. For us, the key point is that we have some kind of finite dimensionality of this H1. Look at the center, well, it's in the hierarchy of situation, which you can express by the finiteness of these sums. In some sense, they have, well, maybe they are not finite dimensional, but the space of global sections is finite dimensional over the field with one element, if you wish. Mm-hmm. So this sum is really converge and define some invariant which is a finite invariant. And basically by using the kind of results and the type of inequality between H0, H0 theta I described before, you can construct in that case a non-trivial section of sufficiently many non-trivial sections of a tilde twisted by an ample line bundle. And here again, we know we have at our disposal the analog of some Chow theorem, which is some class given by different approximation constructions, and you can conclude. Okay, thank you for your attention.